third case for oral argument this morning is in the interest of DM, a minor child, concerning the Department of Social Services, respondent in Annapolis, and Beth and DJD appellants. For the appellants is Ms. Deborah Watson, an attorney from Rapid City. For the appellate, Department of Social Services, is Ms. Ann Holhauser, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Ms. Watson, you may proceed.
Good morning. As the court indicated, my name is Deborah Watson. I'm an attorney in Rapid City. I'm with the law firm of Watson and McGowan. May it please the court. Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices Meyer, Henry, Sabers, Coney, Camp, and Zinter, opposing counsel, Ms. Holthauser, members of the audience, and law clerks. For the benefit of our audience, I will begin with a brief recitation of the facts. This matter is about a seven-year-old girl. To preserve her confidentiality, she will be referred to by the description child rather than by her name. Her father sexually abused her and was sentenced to the penitentiary. Her mother is an alcoholic who could not maintain her sobriety. Neither were fit to parent her, and their rights were involuntarily terminated by the court. The child was then placed on by the trial court with the Department of Social Services for adoption. A search was then made by the Department of Available Families for adoptive placement of this child. Three families were ultimately approved by the department as suitable to adopt the child, two relatives and a foster family. The department selected the foster family over either of the relatives to be the adoptive parents. And for simplicity purposes, I only represent one husband and wife, one of the relatives. But I think rather than using initials, if it's acceptable with the court, I'll just refer to my client as the relatives. The other relatives didn't want to intervene, excuse me, so they're not part of this process. So I represent one of the relative placements approved by the department. They are the child's great aunt and great uncle on her mother's side. Now, upon being notified of the department's decision to reject the relatives over the foster family, the relatives immediately moved to intervene in the pending abuse and neglect action seeking adoptive placement through the court.
How much time had passed between the adjudication of termination, and I know it was appealed and returned, and the time your clients got involved in it?
Well, Your Honor, we weren't privy, of course, since there are secret proceedings as to exactly what occurred. What I can tell you, what's been released to me, is that apparently Dad's rights were terminated in December of 2001. Mom's rights were terminated in January 2002. Apparently, Dad appealed the termination of his parental rights, I believe, in late January of 2002. That appeal was decided against the father. And basically, the permanency hearing that we attended would have been, as I understand it, the first one after receiving the Supreme Court's decision after the child had been cleared for adoption. We first appeared in September at that permanency hearing, and that was, as I indicated, the earliest possible time that after the child had been cleared for adoption that we really were in a position to come forward. And just to kind of give you a little history, my clients, the relatives, were contacted by the department in January following mom's termination. They apparently also had contact with other family members because the family felt that they were in the best position to adopt this child. So once the department contacted them, asked if they were interested, the responsible thing and said, you know, let us think about it, because the department did disclose to them, rightfully so, that this child had some behavioral issues as a result of her sexual abuse. They then reported back to the department roughly a month later that they were interested. Then they went through all of the department protocol with the pride classes, the investigation, search of their records, the home study, and then we received the positive home study. within 1 week of the relatives being advised that they had been refused by the department as an adoptive placement order.
They were never approached for placement prior to that time.
No, Your Honor, they weren't. And I suspect probably the reason that that was is the relatives lived in eastern South Dakota. The mother lived in Rapid City. And as you can imagine, the department's obligation, first of all, is to attempt to reconcile the child with her parents. In fact, apparently, the department tried really hard until January to reconcile this child with her mother. Apparently, her mother was able to stop drinking for a while. Unfortunately, she couldn't stop drinking. I understand that things got really ugly. The police even had to pull this child out of the mother's arms when she was taken away. So it has been a traumatic situation for the child. But these parties would not be in a position to be an interim placement because of their geographic location. They just were way too far away. The department's required to give the mother visits and try to reintegrate her. So because of the geographical distance, I don't think that would have been an option, Justice Meyer.
Was there any place in the record, and I've read parts of it, and I haven't seen it necessarily, where the department actually indicated to the court or the parties what their policy was on placement with relatives as opposed to non-relative placement? I think there's some reference to it by one of the attorneys, but is there a written policy or was that ever pursued during any of these proceedings?
I did inquire of the department what their policy was in just selecting adoptive families. I was advised that there is no written policy, that they have this conference call. If you review the transcript at the hearing, Judge Kern inquired what the procedure was, and they indicated that they had a number of individuals that they had to take part in the conference call. Most of the individuals were local. They had a supervisor out of here. I believe also a social worker out of, I don't know if it was Mitchell or Chamberlain or somewhere else. But then two or three local DSS workers. A couple of the workers were the ones that were on this child's case.
But someone said, and I know it was one of the attorneys, said that it was their policy, maybe unwritten, to try to find relative placements. Is that...
I do believe, and I think the state probably said that, that it is their policy that they do.
But there was no evidence ever presented that they have that policy necessarily.
I've never seen it in writing.
Did you ever get into the record all of the information that related to this home study and all of the background information on your clients?
I did, Your Honor. Although the court denied us an evidentiary hearing, she did allow us to submit, actually she requested that I be provided since those were secret documents, so to speak also. But she did provide to me and make a part of the court record the home studies on both of the relatives and on the foster family.
But do you think then that did she ever consider the case on the merits between the relative and the non-relative placement?
I do not believe so, Justice Abrams. I don't think that she got that far.
Well, to kind of cut to the quick, how could she reach the conclusion that that it's not in the best interest of the child? It would be too much delay without knowing what the facts are or without making those two considerations.
Well, that's our position, Your Honor, is that we do need an evidentiary hearing. At this point, all the trial court will hear is DSS coming forward with the home study on the foster family. The court would not, and of course, if the court has to determine what's in the child's best interest. I don't think that the court's obligation is to rubber stamp DSS, although that appeared to be some of the discussions at the trial court level. But the obligation of the court is to look at what's in the best interest of the child, and the only way that the trial court could do that would be to review all the home studies, have information as to the pros and cons of each of the prospective adoptive families that have already been approved by the Department of Social Services.
But doesn't that put the court in the position of being a super adoption agency?
I don't believe so. I think that the ultimate decision as to what is in the best interest of the child rests with the trial court, further looking at permanent placement, choosing parents for this young girl. And I don't think it does, because the department has already done their job. They've said, you know, they're looking for adoptive parents who are interested. Those that are interested then are put through this procedure to ensure that there aren't any issues that could be of concern for this child, and approve those three families. So it really doesn't open up the court to anyone just coming in, because really the only ones fit and willing have already been disclosed to the department. The department's done their job and selected the three families that they feel are suitable.
I don't know the numbers, but I mean, it seems to me that there are thousands of couples who want to adopt children in South Dakota, and who the department says to them, we'll put you on our waiting list, you're qualified, and then they choose a family they think is best for a particular child. And what I think you're saying is that those thousands of couples could go to court and say, we don't particularly appreciate the department's choice. We think that you, the judge, should make another choice of which couple is entitled to this particular child.
Well, I believe that this court's prior decisions probably give us a little guidance, as does the statute. Let me just turn to the statutes relating to abuse and neglect. When they look at placement of a child, and that's why we think that there's a legally enforceable interest in this case, we look at some of the statutes. One in particular is 26-80-21.2. It talks about the court's requirement to look at a fit and willing relative. And there are other statutes that talk about that. So I think that, Justice Coney Kemp, this case may be different than just anybody coming off the street saying that they weren't chosen.
But where would you draw that line?
Pardon?
Where would you draw that line? I mean, which person could intervene and which could not? I mean, Justice Coney Kemp has hit the nail on the head here, I think. Which kind of person are you going to let in? Which one or not?
Well, I think that, you know, what we're looking at is a sort of a separate issue, because it's a relative, and there are separate statutes dealing with relatives. But I would suggest, Justice Enter, that you would draw the line at those individuals who have been unlicensed by the department to be foster parents. I think that that would be the definition of someone who would then have some sort of right to intervene. As Justice Coney Kemp indicated, there are a number of people who do want children. Unfortunately, those people usually want healthy white children, not children who have been abused and neglected. We have lots of children abused and neglected who are available for adoption. Adoption would love to be adopted at this time. We have children who nobody wants, who have been abused and adopted. So we don't really see a rush to court to adopt abused and neglected children. I've been handling these kind of cases for about 25 years. I can only think of three times when there was a dispute over what was in the best interest of the child in terms of adoptive placement.
Well, we've repeatedly said it's in the best interest of the child to have permanency. And what you're asking looks to me is the reverse of that. You want to go back, have a full-blown trial to determine who would be the best to raise this girl, and then more than likely another appeal up here. You're not talking months, we're talking years, potentially, before this child determines what home she will live with until she's 18.
Well, I believe you're right, Justice Gilbertson. We all want permanency for this child. And the law is that we need to look at what's in her best interest. The dispute is what is in her best interest. And we don't believe that expediency should be substituted for best interest. In our circuit, at least, in Western South Dakota, we're able to get a hearing relatively quickly. I think an expedited hearing, and that's what, you know, we're all required to do, is resolve these issues regarding children as quickly as possible. In our circuit, we can get a hearing within 30 to 60 days. A lot of the work has already been done. We have the home studies. We have the information on the child, so it's not like we have to start from scratch, it's going to take us 9 months or a year to do discovery, to be prepared.
Yes, but I mean, this child was cleared for adoption in August of 2002. Now it's 14 months later, and we're and you're asking us to send it back again for a trial. So, I mean, Justice, Chief Justice Gilbertson points out a real concern here, because suppose the trial doesn't end up the way your clients appreciated. Now we're back in 2004 with another appeal. I mean, this little girl is 7 years old. When does she get to know? I mean, she surely knows she's up for adoption. When does she get to know who her parents are going to be?
Well, and the concern is that, and that was Judge Kern, she's just a wonderful judge, and her concern too was the issue of resolution for this child, and that's always our concern in many cases involving children, is that we get it resolved as quickly as possible.
What was the big rush in Judge Kern's mind? I mean, this child's been through, had a terrible life at this point. What would it take, another 1 or 2 months to determine, say, who was the best between these two sets of adoptive parents that are both have been approved? What was the big rush in her mind that would prevent taking another 2 months to make a decision on the merits after looking at all the facts to see what's in the best interest of the child?
Well, just to say, this is always a hazardous for the lawyers to second guess trial judges, but
you've appealed your decision, so you better do it.
Well, I suspect the concern that she had was that the department had worked with this mom for a long time. Apparently, the department felt that she may be able to get her act together and sober up, but it didn't happen. So the department had worked with the mom for a couple of years, and the judge apparently decided that she wasn't interested in any other adoptive placements. She wanted to get it over with for the child.
Now, you're asking for intervention under 24A, which would have given you a right at that time to present evidence. The judge didn't buy that argument, but did look at it under the Civil Rules of Civil Procedure 24B. Correct?
That's right.
If we were to find that that was all, that her, to review it under B, 24B, would that be an abuse of discretion standard that we would look at there?
It would be, Your Honor.
But under A, it's basically she would have to give you a right to intervene.
That's right.
If we were to accept that argument, what direction would we give the trial court? What would we actually, I mean, obviously you're asking us to reverse it. What direction would we be giving the trial court? What would you envision would be the relief you would seek and the law that you would actually be stating at that point?
We're asking you to advise the trial court that there is a statutory right of intervention by the relatives because they have a legally protected interest in the subject matter of the action. I think that the sole issue before this court on appeal is whether the intervention in this case is permissive or a matter of right. The court said that the relatives could intervene, but it was permissive, not a matter of right. This appears to be a case of first impression in our state. In South Dakota law, and as you know, when they're going through the transcript, we didn't really have a template as to how they really handle the situation, but the law is unclear as to the proper handling of this issue. And we're asking your interpretation of the law based on the facts presented. The statutory interpretation requested, we believe, that the standard of proof is a question of law. Therefore, we believe that this court's standard of review should be de novo, independent of the trial court's findings. The relatives respectfully submit that they have a statutory right to intervene in the abuse and neglect action, and that their intervention is timely. This is my opinion. I refer to STCL 15624A, which provides in pertinent part that upon timely application, anyone shall be permitted to intervene in an action, subsection 2, when the claimant claims an interest relating to the property or transaction which is the subject of the action, and was so situated that the disposition of the action may, as a practical matter, impair or impede his ability to protect that interest, unless the applicant's interest is adequately represented by existing parties. Now, to establish intervention of right, I respectfully submit that the relatives have to establish four factors. One, is that the intervention is timely. Two, that the proposed interveners have a legally protectable interest in the subject of the action. Three, that the disposition of the action may impair or impede the proposed intervener's ability to protect that interest. And four, that the existing parties do not adequately represent the interests of the proposed interveners.
Isn't it the legally protectable action here the real question, whether a great aunt and uncle have any legally protectable interest in adoption of a child?
That is, Justice Montgomery. The judge didn't make any findings on timeliness. In fact, she said that they could intervene. It was just permissive. So let me just turn to that issue of legally protected
interest. Your time is expired, counsel. Ms. Lowell-Houser, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Holmes-Houser. I appear on behalf of the Department of Social Services. The department submits the trial court's decision to deny the motion to intervene in this case filed by the appellants was soundly based upon the law and the child's best interests and was not an abuse of discretion and as a result should be upheld. That raises the first point that I'd like to make, that being the standard of review that should be applied to the trial court's decision to deny the motion to intervene. I think this court has clearly stated in the Baker v. Atkinson decision, as well as the Wimmer, Weiner, the Iparella, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing those names correctly, the standard of review in reviewing the denial of a motion to intervene is that of the abuse of discretion, not as opposing counsel would suggest a conclusion of law. Given that, I would suggest that the trial court's decision to deny the motion to intervene in this case was not an abuse of discretion. I'm not going to take the time to restate the facts in this case because I think they are fairly clear. There's one fact, however, that I think needs to be emphasized, and that is when this case began, and that was back in November of 2000 when the reasonable neglect proceedings were commenced with the filing of a petition. As a result, at the time that the appellants first intervened or first attempted to intervene, the time that they filed appeared before the court and asked permission to present evidence of an evidentiary hearing, 2 years had already expired.
They would have not had any kind of an interest in it until the child was eligible for adoption. Isn't that correct?
I think that they could have contacted the department and expressed their interest. And I think the department, my understanding of the record, the department did contact the appellants back in January, the preceding January.
The court didn't rely on that in making its decision, correct?
I think the court relied in part upon the child's best interests, in large part upon the child's best interests, that it was not in the child's best interest for there to be any further delay.
The part that bothers me is that when the department makes the decision on where they're going to place the child initially.
Correct.
And in this case, the child was there for a while, then went back to mother, and sort of a period of a couple of years, the child was sort of in and out of this foster home, plus I think it was in another foster home for a short period of time.
So I think she spent the majority of her time in the care of this foster home.
Okay. So if you are an interested party in a relative's placement and you want to have the department consider you, you're already out because they've already placed the child in another home, and they're saying, well, she's already in this other home, and therefore she's secure and safe, and we're not going to consider anyone else, relative or non-relative. So you're almost in a catch-22 with the department under your theory, are you not? I mean, you'd never have an opportunity because the department's already made the decision on where to place the child, and the more time frame that goes by, the less anyone else is going to be considered, which is what the case was here.
That's because of the balancing of the requirements that are imposed upon the department. Prior to termination of parental rights, the department must focus its efforts on reuniting the child with the parents. And in this case, it became a physical proximity requirement that the appellants were not near the child where the child was living. Whatever the decision is made, the department has to abide by what's in the best interest of the child.
Well, let's talk about balancing for a minute. The decision is now up to the circuit court judge. And the circuit court judge apparently has all the information on the relative possible for placement and the other one. And instead of saying in a decision then, I choose this one, I approve the department's choice of this one for all of these reasons over this one, on the merits and for those reasons, why wouldn't it be an abuse of discretion not to do that and just simply to say the time frame is such, I mean, the child needs, it's not in the best interest of the child to delay it any longer. I mean, what convinces us that any more delay is absolutely so bad to prevent looking at who actually would be the best to be in the child's best interest?
With all due respect, I think that the court needs to, this court needs to look at who in fact makes that decision, or who should make that decision, what should be the adopted placement for the child. The department acknowledges that pursuant to Code Section 28A29, the trial court has continuing jurisdiction over a child whose parental rights have been terminated. However, by the terms of that section, that jurisdiction is limited. It's limited to reviewing the status of the child and to issuing orders that are necessary to protect the child, to preserve the child's welfare, and to facilitate child adoption.
So what are you saying, that the department makes the decision and not the trial court?
I'm saying that that provision must be read in conjunction with 26A27, which provides, which mandates that the department be given custody and guardianship of the child for purposes of placing the child in adoptive placement.
Right, but if the department errs or the department makes a mistake, the circuit court judge certainly has the right to reverse that decision, doesn't it?
Correct, but I think
that if the circuit court doesn't look at the decision on the merits, why isn't that an abuse of discretion? Why is it not an abuse of discretion just simply to say, we don't have enough time, or time is the priority?
I think that the legislature has recognized, and this court as well, the unique qualifications of the Department of Social Services to make adoptive placements for the child. The department has a staff that's needed to do it. The department has staff that is specifically trained in assessing the needs of children who have been raised in environments of abuse and neglect.
So you think the burden is on the circuit court judge to approve the decision that the department has made without looking at all the facts?
I think that what the statutes contemplate is that the circuit court, the trial court, will defer to the judgment of the department, that unless the trial court is left with a definite or firm conviction that what the department has done is not in the best interest of the child, or is contrary to state or federal law, such as if the department was not moving forward with the placement, or the department's acting contrary to the Human Child Welfare Act, for example. Absent those circumstances, I think the legislature and the prior decisions of this court recognize that the trial court should defer to the decision of the trial court, that the trial court is not in a position
without looking at the facts. They should defer to the department's decision without looking at the merits.
I think that the information that was provided in this case, the record reflects that the trial court was provided with information about each of the options. The trial court was provided with the home studies, and in fact opposing counsel was as well. The trial court conducted a review of what the process was that the department used to make that adoptive placement decision, who made the decision, how they made the decision. Given that information that was available to the court, there was nothing that would indicate that what the department did was contrary to the best interests of the child. In fact, the department presented the recommendations of the therapists and child psychologists who concurred in the recommendation of the department. Absent the objection raised by the appellants, who have had no standing to raise the objection, which is another issue that this court needs to address. Absent that objection, there was no indication before the trial court that what the department did was contrary to the best interests of the child.
What about the department's normal practice of trying to find a relative placement?
I can tell you, I'm not sure that it's in the record, but I can tell you that it is a matter of written policy of the department to, and I have a copy of that policy with me, to look at relatives from the very beginning as a possible placement for children. That there is a recognition that consideration should be given to relatives in placing children.
Would it be appropriate for you to provide that to us?
And Judge, you can go to the council. If not, civil relation, please provide 7 copies to the court within a reasonable time.
And that would be the written policy of the department, correct?
Right.
I will do that.
Can you tell me, do you believe that permissive intervention under Rule 24, is that applicable in the dispositional phase of this A&M, in the department's view?
In the department's view, no. There are a couple of reasons for that. One being the recent legislation amendment to Code Section 25529 that was made effective in February 2002. That amendment to that section makes clear that intervention should not be allowed in abuse and neglect proceedings, that being intervention by relatives or third parties. That alone would prohibit or constitute a bar to the appellant's claim that they have a statutory right of intervention.
I'm asking about permissive intervention, though.
I think that would apply to that as well. And under permissive intervention, the court clearly has a right to look at what is in the best interest of the child based upon the timing. As we've noted here today, the fact alone that we're here today a year after the appellant's stood before the court and requested leave to intervene and requested an evidentiary hearing, the fact that we're here alone is cause to find the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying a motion to intervene.
You have no standing. You said earlier that you believe that these folks had no standing to even intervene. So if they had no standing, then intervention couldn't be by any right. Is that correct?
The
trial court had to say they were standing. The trial court had to say they had some standing to intervene. But you're saying the trial court was wrong, if I understand you.
I'm saying that the trial court was correct in denying the motion to intervene, but I'm also saying that under the recent amendment to Code Section 25529, there's an argument that the appellants had the right to intervene.
But the trial court permitted intervention. So that throws your standing argument out the wall. I mean, the court has ordered that they're permitted to intervene. I mean, you have to appeal from that if you don't like it.
Correct.
Okay, and you didn't.
You did not.
And you didn't. So I don't think that you can argue standing up here at this time, can you? Because you didn't take file notice, you didn't take issue with the fact that the circuit court ordered permissive intervention.
I'm basing my arguments in part upon the arguments that were raised by the appellants in their brief. They relied solely on intervention of right under Code Section 15-6 as 24A, I believe. The appellants did not rely on permissive intervention in their brief. And in order to establish intervention of right, the appellants must show that they have an interest. Whether that be by statute or by case law, the appellants are given the burden of showing that they have a legally recognizable interest. It suggests to you that they have not done so.
Well, that's the trial court has ordered that they have a legally permissible interest, don't they?
I don't think it's clear from the trial court's findings whether or not the trial court was basing its decision on intervention of right or permissive intervention or a combination of the two. What is clear is that the trial court denied the motion of the ruling, obviously.
Okay. Let me ask you just one more question, then I'll get out of here. Once the trial court has granted permissive intervention, which is my read on it, okay, then isn't it an abuse of discretion on the trial court's part not to look at the facts and weigh the merits and say, this person is better than this person, therefore, I'm going to follow the department's lead. To ignore those facts and not look at the merits of the case once you've granted intervention, isn't that an abuse of discretion?
I don't think it is, based on the record before the court in this case. I think it's clear from the statutory sections and the prior decisions of this court that the department has been the agency that's uniquely qualified to make adaptive placement decisions, and that the trial court should give deference to those decisions. I think this court's decision in the NRAJH was an example of the deference that must be given to the department's decision. In that case, if my recollection is correct, the trial court had placed the child in another state, in fact, with a grandparent who had followed, had done all that was necessary, but apparently against the wishes of the department. This court reversed that decision and specifically stated that the court was not going to consider the appropriateness of the placement. In other words, it didn't matter whether or not that placement was in fact an appropriate placement. The trial court had usurped or bypassed the role of the department.
I have a question on following up on something you said earlier. This was the dispositional phase of the abuse and neglect proceeding.
Correct.
And the intervention statute, I think, is more directed at the adjudication phase of it. And the rules of civil procedure apply to the adjudication, or do not apply to the adjudication. Do they or do they not? I mean, I guess I'm, this is a dispositional, and my understanding and my experience with it is really, it's pretty wide open as far as what the court can look at. The evidence, the rules of evidence do not apply. I don't think the rules of civil procedure necessarily apply. This is
That's
a dispositional
correct.
Part
That's
of it. So if the court decides that, as Justice Savers has indicated, that they do have standing, what prevents the court from just saying that? I'm going to let them have standing in this case. And then by not looking at it further, review, you know, maybe it is abuse of discretion at that point.
Well, again, I think we need to look at what the role of the trial court is in the adaptive placement decision process. And in this case, the trial court had all the information that it needed to find that the placement that the department had made, which was to leave the child in the care of her foster parents, with whom she'd been during the majority of the abuse and neglect proceedings, and with whom she had bonded, that the decision to leave her in their care and allow them to adopt her was in her best interest. In fact, both the child's attorney and the CASA volunteer were mandated by law to represent the child's best interest in the proceedings agreed with the department's decision. The only person or persons that disagreed was the appellant. I think on the record, based upon the record, there was no need for the trial court to go further.
You completed your presentation?
Yes, I have. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. I didn't specifically address it, but please furnish Ms. Watson with a copy, too. Okay, thank you. Ms. Watson, you have 10 minutes.
The state's position appears to be that it's up to the Department of Social Services to select adoptive parents in abuse and neglect cases. I respectfully submit that the buck stops with the trial judge. That what is in the child's best interest in terms of her adoptive placement is up to the court. Of course, the department has to follow their procedure and make sure that whatever names are submitted to the trial judge are individuals who are fit, willing, and qualified to accept this child for adoption. But I don't think that the trial court is to just rubber stamp the department's decision. If the trial court only gets one choice, the choice is whether the foster parents are going to be approved or not, and I guess I've never seen them not approved.
Not that you may be wrong in what you're suggesting, but certainly up until today, all the adoption agencies in South Dakota, public and private, have always done the selecting.
they bring their selection to the court, and then the court is asked to approve it. But what you're suggesting today is radically different. You're suggesting that should other people want to challenge it in court, the selection, ultimate selection, will not be made by an adoption agency, it'll be made by the judge. Is that right?
That's not what we're asking, Justice Cunningham. We're limiting this situation to children who are wards of the court. We're saying that fit and willing relatives approved by the department do have standing to intervene. Cases where there's a private adoption.
I understand what you're saying. You want to narrow it to this situation, but still, up until today, that same process that I just described applied to children who are wards of the court. The department, once the department was given full and complete adoptive rights, they made the selection, and you're asking that from now on, judges will make the selection.
No,
I'm misunderstanding that.
I believe judges have always made the selection. But the department has made recommendations. I'm aware of a couple other cases where interveners, parties that were rejected by the department, were allowed by the trial court to intervene and have an evidentiary hearing. And so I don't really think that, we're seeing this occurring, we don't know what to do. And I respectfully submit that all the statute says is that the trial court is the one who's to determine on the best interest of the child. Children that are placed by relatives do so for a reason. They feel that it's best for their child to be placed somewhere else. Although I'm not going there with this case. We're only talking about children who are wards of the state whose parents' rights were involuntarily terminated. And in reviewing the abuse and neglect statutes, you'll see several references that the child should be placed permanently with a fit and willing relative. That the court may place the child in the custody of a guardian or a relative of the child or other suitable person.
You're not reading from an adoption statute, are you, counsel? You're reading from a temporary placement statute.
Yes, I am, from the abuse and neglect, right, in terms of
placement. That's not an adoption statute.
No, it isn't. Basically, the adoption statutes indicate that any person may adopt a child if the child's been in their home for 5 months and whatever the requirements are there. But I don't think that's the issue. Because people who are, parents who want to place a child for adoption should have the right to do so and should have a say in where they're placed. We're talking about parents whose rights were involuntarily terminated. We do believe that both the statute and the federal law also, I wanted to refer to the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, which provides that the state shall consider giving preference to an adult relative over a non-related caregiver when determining a placement for a child, provided that the relative caregiver meets all of the relevant state child protection standards. And that's where we're at, is, if you've met the child protection standards, the statutes do list specifically fit and willing relatives that have to be looked at for placement of the child.
Could we conclude that's public policy?
When I was doing research on this, it did appear that many states had legislation that gave preference to families. In fact, a substantial number of the states do. In fact, a lot of the states said that, absent good cause to the contrary, children who are ward of the state should be placed with relatives. But our statute is a little bit more vague. It just talks about the child should be placed in terms of the permanency hearing with a fit and willing relative. That's one of the options. And that talks about a relative or another suitable person. I do believe that, there aren't enough children. And that's why that the federal government passed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act and the Adoption and Safe Families Act in 1997 is because the Department of Social Services wasn't doing enough to get families involved in placement of the children. And basically what the federal government did to get us to go along with what they wanted to do is to provide money, because what was happening is that money was available so foster parents could take children, but money wasn't available to families to help care for that child. And so the federal government, in order to get states to do more of this, passed these federal laws to encourage it. So it's our position that there is a statutory right The case that I found...
Ms. Watson, before you get to that, I just want to be sure about the issue, because there's a lot of issues involved here today. I want to know, what is the very specific legal issue that this court must decide based on the way this case has come to us? Are you simply asking us to decide intervention as a matter of right under 24A? Is that the question we need to decide?
Well, it's basically twofold. That's the primary question, is intervention as a matter of right. But as Justice Sabres indicated, the other issue is whether there was an abuse of discretion based upon the trial court's refusal to consider the evidence, because the trial court had all of the home studies, refused to let us...
Well, that's 24B. That's 24B.
It is. Our primary position, Justice Inter, is that we do have a statutory right to intervene. I want to refer to the Iowa case. It's in the interest of CLC and AMB. It's a 1991 case. In my research of other states, so this appeared to be the closest case I could find to our fact situation in terms of the specific facts and the statutory laws. The law is different in all states on family law. But in this case, the trial court found that the review was de novo, that the intervention was in the placement part rather than the termination, that it was timely because it was prior to any proceedings to establish permanency. The court in that case found that there was a statutory right, in this case it was grandparents, but of relatives, based upon language exactly like we have found in our statute. They use the word relative or suitable person. And they found a legal right to be considered following the termination of parental rights based on that specific language that the court required to consider a fit and willing relative, a relative of the child or other suitable person.
Did you cite that case in your brief?
I don't believe I did. I found it actually as I was getting ready for the oral argument.
Then I thought we were required to provide 7 copies to the clerk and also copies to both counsel.
Truthfully, most of the states have laws that require parents, relatives, be given placement, so it was really difficult to find any states that had laws similar to ours. At this time, we're asking that the court remand this for an evidentiary hearing so that Judge Kern may consider, for an expedited hearing, so that the judge may consider the relative placement and determine on what is in the best interest of the minor child. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.